Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Okay, my favorite tweet of the day was George Conway, who basically just quoted George Orwell. He accepted everything. The past was alterable. The past never had been altered. Oceania was at war with East Asia. Oceania had always been at war with East Asia. And of course, we've always been at war with coronavirus, right? Let me stipulate that I like the fact that the president has finally acknowledged this is a very it's a big deal. It is a real danger, and that he's changed his tone. What I find absolutely fascinating, though, is watching the pivot, the very predictable pivot of in Trump world, the media. I mean, the pandemic may be unpredictable, but Sean Hannity is absolutely predictable. Whatever Trump says, you know, is not only true, it has always been true, and the adulation is just sort of a given. So I was off yesterday. Today I'm coming back, and I'm, you know, trying to get your head around what's going on. I mean, America is overwhelmed. It is just hard to where to start. You had the stock market absolutely hammered yesterday, the worst day since Black Monday. This comes after the Fed hits the panic button. If it was designed to reassure the markets, it obviously failed. America is closed for business. I think I probably used that line several times, but in the last 24, 48 hours, it just seems like we've gone from some, you know, widespread closings to entire states and cities being shut down. The Kentucky Derby has now been postponed. And, you know, everyone I know is getting text messages and emails almost by the hour saying this is canceled, this is canceled, this is canceled. I think, by the way, and I saw this on Twitter as well, we're 3 to 4 weeks away from finding out what everybody's real hair color is. Do you know what I mean? Because, I mean, people are getting notes from their hairdressers that, yeah, all of my appointments are absolutely canceled. Like, I can't even imagine, by the way, what it's like in the restaurant business. Just, you know, one little comment here, and we'll get to this a little bit later. But I've noticed a lot of the commentary from folks on the left that this crisis is a great argument for Medicare for all. Actually, I would turn that on its head and point out that one of the things we've seen is the power of federalism and the role that local officials and local individuals and private businesses have played in all of this. There's a reason why we have been skeptical. Some of us have been skeptical about the concentration of all power in Washington, D.C. And this is one of those moments where instead of looking to the central government to provide leadership, we saw this from the states. We saw governors and mayors and private businesses and those little platoons of civil society stepping up. Also, we wake up this morning finding out that we are about to experience a geyser of cash because Republicans are realizing something that Democrats have realized for some time, that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste, and that anytime there is a crisis, it's a good reason to spend a great deal of money and to bail out a variety of industries. We're now talking about, the Trump administration is now talking about $850 billion. $850 billion. If you're rolling your eyes about all of this, we're in this dangerous zone where the confusion between millions, hundreds of millions, billions, and trillions of dollars really poses, I think, a real clear and present danger, because people go, whatever it takes, if you have to spend $1 trillion, except that, you know, I just want to kind of raise my hand and say, remember, we've been running this country, we've been running $1 trillion deficits during a time of prosperity. And there were some very, very, very lonely voices saying, maybe you shouldn't do this because you might want to, you know, give yourself a little bit of a cushion if you go into a recession or there's a national emergency. And here we are. There is a national emergency and $850 billion on top of all the other money that we don't have is going to be the hangover is going to be absolutely terrific. And we're talking about the fiscally, not to mention what we're experiencing medically. Over the last couple of days, in the Bulwark, we've had a couple of really fascinating pieces by somebody who actually knows what he's talking about. And I say this because, of course, we live in an age of pundits who have opinions about all kinds of things that assumes a certain expertise that they don't have. We've had a couple of pieces by David Shaywitz, who is a physician scientist, founder of Outstanding Health Tech, which is a Silicon Valley Advisory Service. He's an adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and he has been generous enough to join us on today's podcast. Thanks for joining us today, Doctor.
Charlie, it's a pleasure to be here. You had us all worried yesterday. We didn't hear from you. We're worried about how you were doing.
I am absolutely fine, and I'll tell you, I'm kind of holding off on saying what I was doing yesterday, okay. but it's not health related in any sort of way. Nothing bad whatsoever. I'm not sheltering in place or anything. Now, by the way, you are sheltering in place. Tell me what's going on in Silicon Valley, because over the last 24 hours, that's been one of the more dramatic stories.
Absolutely. Well, the whole Bay Area received an order yesterday that it is time to shelter in place, which I don't think is quite as draconian as it sounds. What it sounds like was, you know, the way the virus is, you know, transmitted is particularly when people gather. And so they had tried to recommend that people spend less time with each other, don't show up to restaurants, don't show up to bars. And not everybody was really heeding that admonition. So they sort of escalated it and said, well, now you're strongly advised. It's not clear what the exactly what the enforcement is, but they really do seem to be a lot clearer about it. I mean, what's driving all of this, and everyone I'm sure has seen the same graphs, is just sort of the exponential rate of growth of number of people infected, where it goes, you know, the whole theory of, you know, of the numbers, the exponential growth. You know, the famous example of the rice on the chessboard, right, where you have one grain and two grains and four, and it seems not very much, and then pretty quickly it gets unmanageable. And that's what everybody is seeing coming up. We're watching the scenes on the television from Italy, and it is terrifying. And the scary aspect, there are two, multiple scary aspects, obviously. And one aspect is, you know, is what happens if you get sick yourself? Everyone is really, really scared, obviously, and particularly for people who are older. And then on top of that, it's the terrifying idea that, well, if you are sick, what if there aren't enough resources? What if we overwhelm? And this is what Cuomo was talking about yesterday. This is what everybody is worrying about, that what happens if, or people would say when, the number of people who require care far exceeds the ability of hospitals to provide these services, something that isn't helped when healthcare workers who tend to, you know, because of their increased exposure, tend to get sick far more often than other people. So even though most people infected, most healthcare workers do okay, you know, they're out of commission for a while. And that's sort of best case. You know, some people, there are several ER doctors or you know, critical care doctors who you hear about who are getting sick. A lot of people are certainly getting exposed. And it's pretty scary out there. So, you know, I'm sort of not here to be alarmist, Charlie, but I think that the concern that some people are having, they're in their voice, I think it's not inappropriate. And I think it is kind of a sober response to a challenging situation that, as you've pointed out, it seems like nationally we're really starting to acknowledge and get our heads around. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to start to see a more of a coherent reaction to this.
Well, you can be alarmist, because obviously we are alarmed. So when they say shelter in place, you're strongly advised. So that's not like a mandate. It's not really enforced.
No, I mean, they're not right. Showing up with, like, you know, I don't see like the National Guard patrolling the streets where we live at all. And there are so many exceptions to there are so many exceptions to this that, you know, many different people can go out for particular reasons. You can go. So it's not like a military lockdown, but I think it is a little bit arresting, the idea of, you know, that you watch it on TV. And again, this is one of those things that, because of how connected everybody is, well, that A, contributed to the distribution of the virus, but then also you're able to sort of get your information in that way, and you're watching what's going on, and you're watching it unfold, the situation in China and in other countries in Asia, and then you're watching it in Europe, and, you know, you can see what's happening. And I think that's, for example, on television yesterday, why Cuomo was making such a strong case for, you know, he's terrified that, you know, in New York, for example, and I'm sure this will happen everywhere, the capacity that is needed to take care of the people who are likely to get sick, it doesn't exist. So, So he was, you know, pleading actually with it. So it's an interesting combination. On the one hand, there are, you know, the states are trying to titrate the responses appropriately, but he was pleading for federal help yesterday. And, you know, it's a little bit unclear what's going to be coming. So, you know, a lot of these crises, I think that, you know, there are times where it's really good to have one side or another sort of argue. But this is, I really strongly believe that this is a time for everybody to try to come together as best we can, because we need much more of the sort of Churchillian approach to how we're going to confront this national crisis and really pull through it together, which we are. You know, we're mm-hmm. remarkably resilient, but it's
well, we're going to find out.
I have incredible faith in our country.
No, I mean, I think we're being tested in so many different areas. I mean, you know, whether you're talking about socially, culturally, politically, economically, you know, and there's going to be, there is going to be a significant hangover to all this. You know, it was interesting as we were shutting down all of these, you know, one city after another was, you know, shutting down, that I was texting back and forth with my daughter who lives in France with her kids, and they were going through this process of shutting down as well, including the sheltering in place. And I think in France they went beyond the concept of strongly advise, and I think that they're going to be a little bit more draconian about this. But you know, when you start to see cities shutting down all the restaurants, all the bars, you know, every cultural and social event, and one of the reasons they're taking this step. It's because we have two populations, and I'm going to grossly simplify this, okay? So, you know, two large populations that do not seem to be taking this seriously. One, we saw over the weekend so many young people who went out clubbing and figuring because they're young, right. they're
immune.
And then number two, you seem to have had, at least up until yesterday, a lot of people in sort of more conservative America who had believed the line, this was all a hoax, this was no big deal. In fact, in order to show that you were a true brave American, you should go out and, you know, shake people's hands and that sort of thing. So you did have, and you know, these are two completely different populations, but that seemed to have tripped the trigger on the part of policymakers that we need to take more dramatic steps because people were not or at least these groups were not voluntarily engaging in the social distancing that was necessary. So is there any reason to believe that these steps will be sufficient if you have millions of Americans that...
You know, that's the worry about it, and particularly since it sounds like the latest data suggests that at least 10% of the transmission of the virus occurs from people who are completely or apparently asymptomatic.
Yeah.
So, you know, everyone's doing all this forehead checking and, you know, do you have a fever? But you can't necessarily tell. It seems to be about as transmissible as the flu versus something like Ebola, which is less transmissible, it seems. And people seem to get a lot sicker, or more people seem to get sicker. Greater fraction of the people infected seem to get more sicker. I want to get back to the point that you were making about, you know, who is infected and how seriously different people are taking it. I think that on the one hand, you're right, there's this sort of this concept of the millennial who in general, you know, may feel invulnerable, and hopefully, you know, the new policies will start to shake them up. But then there's this other issue where you're talking about how I think, you know, John Podhoretz wrote about almost this, I think what he described as this manliness that, to use his term, that people are adopting to sort of show that. And as I think he would also say that it's partially in response to there's, you know, after a while, there's only so much alarmism that anyone can take. So when people continuously say the end is coming, this is the end and that's the end, people start to say, well, wait a minute, maybe, you know, all this catastrophizing, you start to get desensitized to it. So then when a real need for catastrophization comes up, you know, people may not be as responsive as they should be. Now, having said that, I think it's really important. And one of the things I wrote for the Bulwark a couple of days ago was in situations like this. This was an example where the science community, the tech community was saying, oh, this really bad thing is coming. You should listen. And it seemed like, you know, a lot of people who were sort of science skeptical were like, no, that's, you know, it's just a conspiracy. It's something else. We don't believe it. And then, as you were saying, some of those people might seem to be especially predisposed to getting the disease.
Yeah. I mean, if you're predisposed to ignore the media, to ignore expertise, and to take your cues from people who may not know what they're doing, yeah, they would seem to be a more vulnerable population.
And what I was concerned about was that was going to lead among some in the science or tech sort of community or some people who were to this sort of an I told you so attitude, mm-hmm. this sort of I wrote about the example of the Darwin Award. It's sort of this satirical, it's this satirical, you know, sort of faux award that is sort of given to people who more or less do themselves in, through, you know, sort of through their own stupidity. There's I think it was a lawyer, maybe a real estate agent in Seattle, who was trying to demonstrate how safe a window was, and, you know, in a skyscraper, and ran through it. Or the guy who's like, you know, a elephant poacher who, or a rhino poacher who gets stomped to death by an elephant and digested by a lion. Like, those would be sort of canonical Darwin Award winners. But the concern is that people have somehow devalued the people who might be getting illness now, because they're somehow more complicit in it. The idea of, oh, well, you got it because you didn't listen to advice. This serves you right. And I really am concerned about that, because nobody, you know, that we, the one of the nice things about being a physician is you don't sort of titrate your degree of care based on how complicit somebody is or isn't in their illness. You don't do that calculus. You really, and I think this is going to be important for us as a nation, not to try to assign various degrees of culpability, but really we owe it to ourselves to try to take the best care we can of everybody, everybody deserves care. People have a lot of different things going on, and you know, people might listen to advice, might not listen to advice for different reasons, and we deserve to try to take the best care of every single patient we, you know, of the best care of all the patients in front of us, and not to turn this into, see, I told you. And I mean, sometimes we see this happening with sort of the vaccinations, where, you know, it's terrible to see all, you know, these kids who get completely preventable diseases because their parents are vaccine skeptics. And you wouldn't say, well, geez, you know, the Darwin Award serves them right for doing it. It's a tragedy. And I think we really try to provide the best care. The goal of physicians is, and the goal of all of us, every citizen, really should try to offer the most care and compassion and thoughtful you know, concern we can for every person who's afflicted, and not try to turn it into, well, you're 30% responsible for your own illness. We really need to come together and in compassion and understanding.
This would be that that moment. So that was the piece you had in the Bulwark yesterday. Today, You have a very, very pointed piece about which, and I really wanted to talk about this, because, of course, inevitably, you know, people on all ends of the political spectrum try to score political points when there's a crisis. I mean, isn't it interesting how there's a crisis, and suddenly, you know, politicians go, see, this is why we need to do basically their usual hobby horse.
Exactly.
But as you pointed out, what you found both strange and maddening is that when you turn on television, as you did for Sunday night's Democratic debate, you hear politicians like Bernie Sanders offering little but contempt for the honorable, difficult, and demanding work private sector drug developers are doing every day. And it is interesting. This is one of those moments where, if you listen to certain people, the center of all evil are these terrible drug companies. And a lot of people are frustrated at the price of drugs. But this seems a strange time to be demonizing the folks who are out there trying to come up with the life-saving therapy.
I mean, I've been talking about this and writing about this since back when I was, you know, in academia, because it was so irritating. I mean, the real truth about it is nature is incredibly complicated. Biology is complicated. People are complicated. For all the, you know, much heralded advances, and this is another topic I talked about actually in an earlier piece, for science and tech shouldn't really be all that judgmental, because the progress that we've made, you know, what are we offering to people who have, who might be exposed right now or who are at risk? Today, our best advice is essentially this advice from the Middle Ages to quarantine. I mean, really, 700 years old. But there are a lot of things that are being worked on. And what I don't think people appreciate in general is there's this sense that, we've kind of licked science, and then academics or, you know, university researchers do 95% of the research, and then companies come in and then just sort of, you know, take all the profits off the table. And I think that the reality, but it's also true that the work of university physicians and university researchers is absolutely critical and really important. And when I sort of give talks on this, I think that what people really don't emphasize or don't necessarily fully appreciate on either end of it is the real issue is the football field in this analogy is really 200 yards long. So it really is true that if you're in a university, you feel like you're doing like 95 yards worth of work. But then when it goes over to the development is sort of continued, advanced, refined by industry, they're also doing an unbelievable amount of work. So it's essentially much, much harder to come up with progress. And it critically requires collaboration and the best of everyone. You know, we're all
right. No, but I mean, the line would be, but yes, you know, these pharmaceutical companies are driven by profits. They are greedy, that which explains why you have these excessive drug costs. And so therefore, if they are, you know, if they are pushing their business agenda, it will come at the expense of human health. I mean, isn't that sort of the essence of why we regard them as some people regard them as evil villains?
I think that's sort of like, you know, profits or patients where, I mean, if you look at how much capitalism has improved standard of living, have created opportunities, how much it has delivered in almost every aspect, and where people turn for new innovations, for new treatments. I think it's really, you know, I don't think it's the right framing. I think there's an incredible opportunity. There's an urgent need to really get the best of everybody to try to work on developing treatments. Now, in this particular case, I have to tell you, Charlie, it was maddening. Hearing a lot of the rhetoric, including, by the way, from some of our local California representatives who love crapping on the people making new drugs. I'm watching the debate with my three daughters on Sunday night. I'm not watching it with my wife, their mom, because she is a physician, also a physician scientist. She's at a company called Gilead. That has one of the lead, the drugs candidates that's a potential medicine that's closest to clinical use. It's being given to some patients. There's some anecdotal data that widely reported says it may be promising. Nobody knows. And so they have been working 24/7. They've been killing themselves. Everybody there, her team, and many other companies as well, trying to do the best they can to try to come up with treatments. And my kids see, you know, they see their mom. They see their mom, like, you know, just so dedicated, so concerned. And I knew, I met her when we were both in training at Mass General, and I saw the concern that she had for patients who were, I remember when patients to care and her ability just to keep her head. I mean, she's uniquely suited for this particular situation because she's able to really keep her head in a crisis and just to be able to be really, you know, to manage mm-hmm. through challenges. And then she took care of, she had an HIV clinic when she was in infectious disease department. She took care of patients at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa and did research there. So here's somebody who's incredibly passionate and dedicated. And then I'm watching, my kids and I are watching the debate. And what do we see? The very first thing out of Bernie Sanders' mouth is sort of like, you know, I can't do a Larry David, but, you know, these evil drug pharma executives or, you know, with these evil intent. And, you know, basically trying to cancel the people who are working there. And I think it's disgusting. I really was so irritated by it because not only is it like viscerally irritating, but it actually is against the whole liberal small L concept of, of recognizing what everybody has to bring to the table. And, you know, for people who sort of believe more in what I would call the Bart Giamatti view of a liberal education and trying to understand nature and do the best that we can mm-hmm. to make improvements and to make progress, it's critically important to bring everybody together and to leverage the best that's available. And
right.
This is what companies do. I mean, the private sector, whether startups or larger companies or very large companies, they're, you know, again, it's not black and white. And it's not like, oh, if they do something wrong, hell yeah, it should be criticized. Criticize, you know, hospitals for, you know, their contribution to all of the excess healthcare costs where that's appropriate. But an intelligent conversation is good. But the idea of what's happened now is it's become a slur. it kills me to say that when someone works in pharma, it's like, oh, as if they're sort of, you know, working for the mob or like a tobacco company or something. It's disgusting.
Now, I agree with you, but let me give you the flip side of this, the other side. And I had a small personal experience, you know, lost my health insurance. And there was a little bit of a gap before I was able to replace it. A very small gap. Went into my normal pharmacy to get the prescription drug that I have that would normally, right, you know, cost me just, I mean, de minimis cost covered by insurance. And the person said, well, your insurance has lapsed. And I said, well, how much would it cost for me just to pay cash for it? And I'm not kidding you. She said, $900.
Oh, yeah. No, it's absurd. I mean, so by the way, not as a systemic approach, my unofficial pragmatic advice is there's this great thing. I was religion. It was a startup called GoodR. I had nothing to do with it, but it's called GoodRx. Yeah. That actually is like offers really helpful for people just in those many of those situations.
It was one of those moments, and I'm thinking, okay, somebody in a different position, and I was able to you know get the insurance thing taken care of, sort of. But I think, how many people in this country do not get the drugs, do not take the drugs, and become much more ill or even die because they cannot afford these drugs, which from a layman's point of view appear to be obscenely overpriced. Now, I'm playing devil's advocate with you, but I think that the people, the when Bernie Sanders says this, he's not talking about the researchers and the people who are doing their best. He's talking about the guys up in the C-suites who are pricing this, looking at their stock price. And again, I'm playing devil's advocate because I'm a free market guy.
No, it's appropriate. Here's the thing. I don't even disagree with like that concern. I think it's an incredibly relevant national conversation to have because we've all been in that situation or a variation of that where there was some procedure, there was something, whether it's sometimes it may be a medicine, sometimes it might be a doctor's visit, a specialist visit. Even people who have insurance, even people who think they have good insurance, suddenly find these massive charges that are appearing. So to the extent that and in fact, it's precisely because it's such a relevant concern that the approach of just, you know, having these, great greedy pharmaceutical companies are responsible for all the evil and should sort of be dismissed, actually makes an intelligent conversation more difficult. Right. I mean, I think the real truth is it's very hard to, the challenge is ensuring that we can balance on the one hand, ready access to life-saving medicines with what some people have pointed out is, you know, the worst, not, I hate to say the worst, but an additional bad type of access is when a life-saving medicine was never invented no one developed it. So there's sort of all sorts of different ranges, but they sort of all have to be on the table. So it's not just, well, I mean, I can't imagine. I know there's like the situation, you know, I trained as an endocrinologist, and the situation with insulin is disgusting, where people who used to have insulin at one particular price suddenly can't be able to afford it because of the year-on-year, sometimes twice a year price increases. That's really hard to understand. And it's and I think, to one of the real challenges is it is so incredibly difficult and risky to develop new drugs. The almost every single thing that people try to develop doesn't pan out. And so to keep on going and going and going and to essentially be able to eventually come up with something, there has to be some type of incentive. Now, there's a very reasonable conversation. One of the most thoughtful people is actually Peter Bach at Sloan Kettering, who's really pushed back, the way you're describing it in a very thoughtful way. He has a whole center for this, is trying to be very, very thoughtful about this. And he's also a beautiful writer about how do you balance, incenting innovation on the one hand with, what's quote an appropriate profit. I mean, really the best thing that any of us could do would be to have the science and technology advance to the point where it wouldn't be like an incredibly, so here, let me tell you something, Charlie. When you talk to CEOs, and this is like on the record stuff, not like, in some cloakroom, when you talk to the head of Novartis, you talk to the head of Merck, and these are all like public quotes about some medicine succeeding, you know how they describe it? They say it's a miracle, like a miracle. Like when you have a new car, you don't say, oh, it's a miracle. When you have, you know, a new microwave, oh, it's a new model, oh, it's a miracle. But when you to have a new product in a pharma company, it, I mean, to have the heads of the company, the heads of R&D at Merck, the head of the CEO at Novartis say a new, you know, impactful medicine effectively represents a miracle. I mean, that makes for a really challenging business model. So the real thing that we need to try to do, and this is, you know, maybe where some of the tech stuff comes in theory could come in, would be trying to get better at making medicines. So it wasn't this massive investment in, you know, mostly for what fails. A lot of the cost of drug development isn't only the cost of developing an individual medicine, but it's also the sunk cost of all the programs that you're trying to develop that crash and burn for reasons you would never have guessed. And trying to account for all of that, those resources is really where
this is where it really becomes complicated, because it is a miracle. And the fact is that American companies are, you know, performing these miracles at a rate, you know, far above others. And so the free market system has worked in that respect. But I guess the question is, then how do you balance that out against that mother or that father that can't afford the insulin for to the in, insulin treatment?
100%. And I absolutely.
And so the miracle is out of reach for tens of millions of Americans who may die as a result. Look, this is the balance of the genius of the incentive system. And I do understand, I mean, so that you understand the political appeal when AOC or Bernie Sanders says, well, all of this stuff should be free. Well, yes, but somebody needs to be paid for all of this. Somebody needs to invest in all of this. And
what's so frustrating is the point is even right at another level. Really, it's been the, American citizens, American patients who have paid for drug development for the entire world.
Right.
So it's kind of been nice for all these other, for many of these, you know, it's more complicated, but at a level, a first level of approximation, you know, basically because people can charge so much in the United States, and they do, it's the United States market that is supporting the development of all these innovative drugs that subsequently then all these other countries can use typically or often at a far lower rate. And that's a real challenge to how do you manage that?
Yeah, well, so what would happen though if you took out the pressure to create, to have profits from this? What if you made the entire industry's nonprofit? What if under Medicare for All, we had drug research for all, and it was funded in the way that we funded, say, the effort to go to the moon? That this was regarded as basic research in the public interest, and therefore it was not a private sector free market enterprise anymore.
Would you? My gosh! If, as you know, we all are future patients, unfortunately, most likely. Mm-hmm. It's so funny because people actually contrast the moon mission of Roger Perlmutter, the head of Merck Research, specifically talks about how actually making new drugs is so much harder than actually going to the moon, because that, he just said, was basically an engineering project. Whereas trying to figure out how nature works, messy, uncertain nature, is in a way so much harder. So to your exact question, I agree that many, on that side of the spectrum have this belief that, the government can do it. And I would not ever want to, I have greatest respect for like the work that's being done as incredible partners, as researchers, but I would never want the government to be the ones responsible or somehow overseeing the development of new medicines. I mean, to watch what happens in startups, to watch what happens in companies, mm-hmm. to watch the incredible sort of focus and intensity, and it isn't say that, it's not to say that it doesn't happen, that there isn't concern and focus in government labs, but the way private industry, the private sector takes on and kicks the butt of a challenge, it's incredible. I think that's what really, I didn't start off like, oh, private sector, private sector, that. It was actually my experiences being, working in lab, taking care of patients, and then I basically sort of spend a little bit of time at a, essentially like as an advisor at a VC fund, and watching these, these entrepreneurs come in and pitch in this incredibly focused way, these solutions and to innovate, and the intensity and the focus on really delivering something. And if you're in a company, your output is, do you make something that people really need or not? You're not like checking, government incentives are complicated, and there's a huge value of a lot of public sector work. There's many things that require the public sector. There are many things that require the collaboration of the private sector and public sector. But I think that in terms of entrusting the responsibility for innovation, for driving products to market, I think the biopharmaceutical industry does that in an unbelievably effective fashion. Now we need to do a better job of figuring out there are parts that I do very well. The sort of the scaling is done very well, and the being able to do studies, and even the many parts that I was just describing that are difficult. They would only be so much worse and so much slow if they were done. I mean, what do you want, like in some Soviet style way? Like how many? Like what have they delivered for us?
See, this is of course the argument when you look at government bureaucracy. I want to switch gears a little bit because I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. That really is concerning. A lot of the headlines today are the economic stimulus and, the $850 billion economic package. You have the Treasury and the Fed taking steps to revive the corporate debt market. But I want to keep coming back to the healthcare crisis that we have. All of this money is being put out there, and maybe some of it is necessary. I think a lot of it's going to be incredibly wasteful. But are we addressing the question of the number of tests, the number of beds, the number of ventilators? And you raised the point earlier that we lack the infrastructure, the healthcare infrastructure to handle something like this. I mean, is that a fair statement that we just don't have enough beds, we don't have enough staff to be able to handle something like this right now?
Right. So that's what I'm hearing, and that's what
scary.
Cuomo, and I think it's scary. Now, one of the things, again, most of what I focus on is actually the application of technology or how technology can be helpful. I think and I've written about that for the Bulwark. I think that technology is often a little bit overstated, overhyped, but one of the things we're going to have a real chance to see during some of this, crisis is how some of the advances in digital health, in sort of mobile technologies, in sort of remote healthcare, telehealth, which isn't this like brand new concept that some people describe it like that, but it's a real stress. I mean, as many have pointed out, crises are stress tests for many aspects of the system. And one of the sort of the technology-based aspect that I think may come out well from this, or that may acquit itself honorably, is the telehealth and the some aspects of remote care. Now, I'm a huge believer in actually, under normal circumstances, one-on-one. I have incredible belief in the effect of a therapeutic. So
what does that mean? Instead of going to see a doctor or going to a hospital, that I sit here and I have a teleconference with them while I'm
well. It means that your initial encounter might be that way. That if you're basically a healthy person who wakes up with some joint pain, say, and then you've been hearing nonstop on television how everybody, there's this, Armageddon is coming, and then you have some joint pain, you're like, oh, this is a sentinel symptom. So so choices of A, going to the doctor, or B, having an initial conversation with the healthcare provider through a telehealth style app. And in many cases, that initial interaction could be really helpful. They might be able to say, well, here, in your case, maybe take some Motrin. It's probably far more common that it's some joint pain. Or they might say, okay, well, what about this? They might be able to do more of a history. And then they might say, oh, actually, you sound like you might be really, God forbid, at high risk for corona, you should come in, but don't go into the main center where you just infect everybody else. Go into this special this dedicated place where we can sort of take care of you, in an appropriate fashion. In other words, sort of pre-triage people.
I mean, is that something in the future, or is that something we're going to be able to or have to scale up in the next several months?
Well, I think a lot of, that's why I'm, you know, this is, again, it's so funny because even when I wrote for The Bulwark was how so much of the discussion of technology really was, struck me as over-optimistic, how all this great stuff that this coronavirus crisis is demonstrating about technology, you know, and how it's going to cure everything. And it's like, no, actually, you know, it didn't, you know, there's a lot of limitations. But one area where I think that there's been a lot of implementation already in many medical centers has been things like telehealth, has been remote care.
When we have people come down with it, though, they're going to have to go
to ICU. Yes. No, that's separate. I completely agree.
And I saw a statistic, and I'm trying to put my hands on it, and I'm not able to right now, that I would have thought that we would have more beds per capita than, say, Italy, but that we don't, that their system is being overwhelmed. And our system, if in fact the worst case scenarios come true, we just do not have that kind of infrastructure. And that's what Governor Cuomo was talking about, what you were mentioning a little bit earlier. I mean, that's got to be it.
That is what is so scary, is the idea that people are going to, not just that people are going to get sick, but, you know, there's so much that you know, everyone, they take it to some degree, they think, well, God forbid, if they're ever sick, you go to the hospital and there's a certain level of care that you sort of expect. And the idea that, well, people are somehow being, you know, you hear these stories that people are being, you know, they're being triaged based on how, not just triaged based on level of illness, but there are these life and death decisions where here you get prioritized for care, but you're a little bit older. I think it's already so difficult for older Americans. It's harder for them to get diagnostic tests. It's harder, you know, there's been such a culture of we want to be understanding. There's this idea that people get older, and so we should sort of be more, not try to force medical care on them and enable them to pass gently. But a lot of people are living older and healthier, like everyone who's running for president. And many of them are incredibly active and are eager to live. And we owe it to bring them the very best prevention and the very best care, and not to kind of tail off just because people are a little older or a little sicker. And there's nothing that strikes me as would be less American than sort of consigning people who are a little bit older or, you know, a little bit sicker to say, well, you know, tough luck. And I think that's what terrifies everybody.
Well, and that's, of course, the danger of rationing. Okay, so speaking of older Americans, at-risk Americans, here's some pretty bad news. While you and I have been speaking, there's a new poll released by the Kaiser Family Foundation finding that at-risk Americans are not taking more precautions than other people. Americans who face the greatest risk of developing serious health conditions from the COVID-19 infection are not being more careful than lower-risk groups. The Center for Disease Control considers high-risk groups people older than 60, those who have chronic health conditions, those who live in households with somebody who does. This KFF poll, the Kaiser Family Foundation poll, asked respondents about five types of precautions, canceling plans to attend large gatherings, stocking up on supplies, working with and conducting other activities from home, using a protective mask, and basically 60 older, other high-risk groups took the same level of precautions as all adults overall, despite the increased risk. So,
you know, Charlie, denial is such a powerful force, and it's not sustainable given what is happening. And I think a lot of it also relates to the fact that, you know, other than these basic measures, you know, people are terrified because it's not clear what else they can do. Okay, you know, you can clean your hands and you can try to avoid gathering. But otherwise, for many of us, it feels like, you know, you're kind of more or less, you know, trying to get through your normal work, your normal day, but like sitting around waiting for, you know, like the sword of Damocles to drop. And it's, you know, it's a very terrifying way to live. And I think particularly for people who are older and who are at risk, you know, you'd like to, you'd really hope that in particular, well, hopefully, you know, like you're reminding, you're making, you know, us discussing it on the program today and the frequent reminders on television, you know, people will start to get the message. I'm just intrinsically an optimist at heart. I'm optimistic that we will get through this. I'm optimistic that people will start to get the message, and maybe the combination of technology and science will really, and collaboration will really start to deliver some treatments for people who are sick, and we'll have the, you know, empathy to take care of everybody who is sick.
Now, see, here's the irony of all of this. Let's say that all of these things work. Let's say that the country has responded enough, is taking steps that are dramatic enough that we have, minimize the impact. You know that there will be a large portion of the population that will say, see, it was no big deal. You guys were crying wolf. And the next time we have a crisis like this, we're going to be less inclined to believe you. So in other words, the success carries its own risks. Do you follow
me? You know what, Charlie? I would love to be honest with you, just from a human perspective, that would be a great outcome. Like, yes, if that happened, if this turned out to be less severe than people were thinking, and the big outcome was for people who were skeptical to say, I told you so, I would say, God bless. That would be terrific. What really worries me is really the opposite, is that it's going to be along the lines of what people are talking about, what, you know, Scott Gottlieb, many others, very thoughtful, sober people are, really concerned. And I think that we should take this concern seriously. And I respond with the seriousness that it deserves. And I really hope that this strikes to me as a deeper problem and a deeper opportunity for people to come together than sort of the typical, I told you so. I mean, we tried that for the first month of, oh, it was this, it was a hoax, or it was something else. That really didn't stick, because it clearly isn't. I mean, just the last point, Charlie, the reason I went into medicine and not something like law or anything like that was because I always thought that in medicine and in science, there's an underlying substance that isn't, was a phone call perfect or not? Well, if there's a majority of people in one party, it was perfect. A majority of people in the other, it's not. What's the underlying truth? But in something, here's something that has an underlying reality to it. Here's this virus, here's this condition, and the opportunity, and it's a really, the idea that we can work together to understand and to overcome it seems just an urgent need and an opportunity for everybody.
Well, I hope you are right, and I hope it plays out that way. David Chaiwetz, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today and being so generous with your time.
Pleasure to be here and speaking with you. I love the show.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.